This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Breast cancer is the second leading cause of death in women aged 35 to 54. I thought we'd start today's program with that number just to remind people that even though breast cancer awareness has grown and treatments have improved, it's still a deadly disease.
In the last couple of years, we've seen huge strides made in treatment. And during this period, the survival rate has increased, and we're now approaching 90%.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to the author of the fifth edition of the Breast Cancer Survival Manual about how much has changed since the book was first published.
We'll also head to the kitchen, where the sneaky chef will talk about her latest collection of speedy, healthy recipes. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show.
Few things in a woman's life can be as terrifying and as confusing as a diagnosis of breast cancer. And finding accurate information about the disease can be the first step in a woman's battle. The Breast Cancer Survival Manual, 5th edition, is a concise information-packed guide which has recently been revised to include all of the latest findings to help women facing treatment for breast cancer feel informed and empowered and to become active participants in the development of their unique treatment and survival plans. Here to talk about the latest edition of the book is the author, Dr. John Link, a medical oncologist dedicated to the care of women with breast cancer in Orange County, California. He spoke with the Health Show's Joe Donahue about the first edition of the book, which was published back in 1998.
I was the founder and director of a major breast cancer diagnostic and treatment center in Southern California, and I wrote the original manual 14 years ago just for our newly diagnosed patients. And it was so helpful for them that we decided to actually make it available to women all over the U.S. and the world, actually. So we published it, and so it's been very successful and very helpful, I think. So that's how it all started.
That practice is BreastLink Medical Group in Southern California. Since the book was first published, is it encouraging to see what has changed?
Yes. I mean, it's actually amazing. If you look at the first edition versus this new edition, I would say about 70 to 80% of information is updated and is new. And in fact, between the fourth and the fifth edition, I would say 30 to 40% of the information is new, particularly around treatment options and treatment. In the last couple of years, we've seen huge strides made in treatment, particularly in new targeted therapies for women with breast cancer, new approaches surgically. So things really, and during this period, the cure rate, the survival rate has increased, and we're now just approaching 90%. So somewhere between 8 and 9 out of every 10 women will be cured of the disease.
When we talk about treatment and planning for treatment, you talk in the book about this new genomic classifications of breast cancer. Why is that important?
Well, we used to basically look at a breast cancer under the microscope and describe it. Now, since the Human Genome Project has sequenced the entire human DNA, we can now look at breast cancer cells and look at how they differ from the normal breast cell and how they differ from each other. So we now can divide breast cancer into four specific groupings, and we can really plan therapy based on that grouping because they're treated very differently.
And does it change the level of treatment in the sense of are we seeing less use of chemotherapy than we used to?
Yes, I think that's a really good point. With this genomic typing and also genomic testing, looking at which women will respond to chemotherapy, which won't, we are using about 30 to 40% less chemo than we did 4 years ago. So along with the cure rate improving, we're actually using less toxic therapy. So things are really being, I think, refined.
And what about surgery?
Surgery, we're doing, again, less surgery than we used to. The surgeons, the breast cancer surgeons, are getting better and better. They've learned from their plastic surgery colleagues how to keep scars small and not cause deformities or divots in the breast from the surgery. We are doing much less lymph node surgery, which is very good because we can get the same information now from imaging. And by looking at the very first lymph node only, so that that avoids doing what we call axillary resections, where we removed all of the lymph nodes, or practically all of them, under the armpit. We hardly ever have to do that anymore. And so women are less prone to this condition called lymphedema. So that is a major improvement in the last couple of years.
So chemotherapy and surgery that were very much in the forefront of our treatment, those have been replaced with what?
Well, we still do surgery. We still remove the cancer. We do different types of radiation than we used to. We do much more limited radiation. We now, and as far as protecting the woman in case cells have escaped, we have targeted therapies. We know which women do need chemo, and we haven't eliminated chemotherapy completely. We've just reduced the number of women that require it. But when we use it, women really need it, particularly in one of the four types of breast cancer, this genomic classification called the HER2 or the HER2 type. So things have been markedly refined, but we have 9 FDA targeted therapies for breast cancer now that we use in our armamentarium. So, you know, surgery's not gone. We still do limited surgery, but it's certainly not as deforming. And we still do a lymph node surgery, but it's only removing the first lymph node usually. And we do less chemotherapy and more targeted therapy. So that's kind of where we're at, with an improved survival rate.
And for those that are at a high genetic risk, what about preventative drugs?
Yeah. For those women at a high hereditary kind of genetic increased risk, and these are women that that carry a gene they have inherited from either their father or their mother, it's come down through their family, it's called the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene. Our approach usually is very careful surveillance when we know a woman has one of these genes, because she has about a 50% risk of getting breast cancer before her 50th birthday. And she's also prone to ovarian cancer. So many of these women will decide to have their breast tissue removed at some point, and after childbearing, usually have their ovaries removed. Drugs are not—they are not the mainstay. They help a little bit, but they're not the answer to this high-risk women.
You write in the book, and we've been talking about many of the changes, many of the advances. But one of the things that you wrote about in the initial book, and you write about in this book, is how important it is to get a second opinion.
Correct. And, you know, I don't think all women with newly diagnosed breast cancer need a second opinion. I think for those women that find themselves in a medical environment where there's not a team approach, where her doctors aren't talking to each other, or if she's just not feeling completely confident about the treatment plan that's been proposed, I think it's very acceptable these days for her to go outside her medical system and get an outside opinion. And I think we in the medical practice, I think we accept this. And actually, in our practice, we actually encourage it if a woman really feels she needs to do it. And certainly we want every woman, when she starts this journey, this treatment we want her to feel confident that she is on the right path.
You're right at the very beginning of the book, the first sentence of the book, of that this book is a crisis manual. And that's important to know that such a volume is out there.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very pleased with it. I think it really has the potential to help women.
And assuming that here we are in our fifth edition and we've talked about the great changes and improvements that have been made, I assume that you have optimism that those figures will only get better.
Yes. Yes. So the book is pretty current. I mean, it was released yesterday. So it is, as current as a written book can be, but there will be updates along the way until another revision is required. So if listeners want to go to my website, we will have updates on the book, and it's drjohnlink.com.
Again, the name of Dr. John Link's book is The Breast Cancer Survival Manual, 5th Edition. He spoke with The Health Show's Joe Donahue.
Still to come, you can be sneaky, speedy, and healthy, too. We'll explain next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1279.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
It can be a bit of a chore convincing kids that broccoli and spinach are good for the body and that ice cream and french fries are those sometimes items. And of course, getting home from work and putting together a nutritious meal gets a little harder as the week wears on. Missy Chase Lapine knows that story very well and decided to do something about it. She became known as the Sneaky Chef. She added more veggies and fruits to everyday recipes to create meals filled with nutrition and not just for kids. Then she took on the time constraints. Her new book is called The Speedy Sneaky Chef. She spoke about the new book with The Health Show's Katie Britton.
I'm a mom of desperation. I have kids who are picky, and a lot of us do. And it's very hard to get them to understand the big picture, why you need to eat healthy or, you know, that their cholesterol levels will go up. Kids don't care about that. They want what tastes good now, and it's very hard to rationalize or really reason with them. So sometimes you have to just work with their favorite foods and make them that much healthier, and so it's a total win-win for mom and for the kids.
And you make the point that, like most other things, kids want to be like their friends, and their eating habits are no different.
We have a lot of competition out there. I mean, the kids, you know, what happens is you send your child to school with a wonderful fresh fruit or vegetable snack, and Johnny next to them at the table pulls out the package good of cheese pops or whatever, and sure, that looks a lot better, and it's crunchy, and it's very hard to compete with the packaged goods on the market today with a fresh food, because fresh food is not always as appealing to the kids. And so they're either trading it or coming home and complaining, or, you know, it's tough competition. But I think what I do as a sneaky chef is give parents very simple ways to actually compete very effectively with the junk food.
And it's not just parents, but companies, they're beginning to add extra nutrients to their products as well.
They're wising up. They're listening to us, you know. There's some really interesting products coming out, and I'm interested in seeing where it develops. I think that, you know, that they're taking notice that we've got to make food very kid-friendly and yet healthier. That's sort of the holy grail. It has to be acceptable, because, Katie, a food is only healthy if you can get a child to eat it.
Now, truth be told, it's a heck of a lot easier to grab something from the freezer to feed the family after a long day at work and picking up the kids from their activities. So what?
It sure is. But here's the thing. Yeah, you can grab something from the freezer, and there are some better products out there. However, What you can also do is when you do have an extra few minutes, make ahead your own. Okay, for example, I have these, my favorite recipe in my new book is Parmesan chicken fries. They look like French fries, but they're made of chicken. They have a whole grain breading, and they're not deep fried. They're oven crisp. They're absolutely crunchy, delicious, and fun. I make 3-4 batches of those ahead, and I actually freeze them in a baggie. And then I have an instant, my own instant convenience food. They took me 15 minutes to make, and I can reach in and grab a few and throw them in the toaster oven or the microwave, and I have convenience food, you know, that I made myself.
I find that so interesting that you have a whole section on the Make Ahead instant recipes. It would never occur to me to make our own kind of boxed mix.
You know, it's really simple. I think people get a little psyched out, and there's no reason to. I'm trying to demystify this whole industry, really. I mean, it's not difficult, and I've done a lot of the hard work, so my readers don't have to. I try to make super moms and super parents out of people and make them an instant success. If you're going to take the time to make ahead your own yellow cake mix using my book, I want that cake mix to work. So I've tested everything, and I make sure that your time is not wasted. There's nothing worse, as we parents are very busy and money's tight, that you go ahead and make something out of a book, or you just take the time to make dinner and no one eats it, or they fight with you about it, and that's just a shame, and then you end up throwing it away. So what I try to do is make you an instant hero and also not waste the food.
So I'd like to talk about the purees, which are used in many of the recipes. They're really quite simple and can be frozen.
Yes, the purees have become sort of my trademark. Here's the thing about, you know, in the old days, sneaking, it's an age-old concept, right? Or perhaps our grandparents were putting cod liver oil into our milk or something weird. they were putting something in something somewhere, right? My mom was putting wheat germ in everything. But here's the thing with my purees. They're a heck of a lot simpler. It's simpler to just steam up a veggie like carrots, and in my case, carrots and sweet potatoes make up my orange puree. Throw it in your little blender, your little food processor, the little one I like, it's easy to use, and in 30 seconds or less, you have what's called a puree. Fancy word, what does it mean? It's kind of like a baby food, but it actually took 30 seconds to make. Anyone can do it. You can make them ahead, as you said, throw them in the freezer. So there's never a time I'm going to serve anything with a marinara or a tomato sauce that's not instantly fortified with one or two of my vegetable purees, like the sweet potato carrot puree, which will make any tomato sauce a lot more, you know, less acidic and healthier and less fattening. So overall, it's nutrient boosted. It's a total winner in that case. And it's sweeter, so the kids love it anyway. But carrots just do that to everything, even their mac and cheese.
Well, that was another thing. Aside from your own recipes, you have quick fix-its for our pre-boxed items like the ranch dressing or the store-bought tomato.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the ranch dressing. Everybody wants to dip, right? Dipping is the name of the game. And here's our favorite dip, which is ranch dressing. Loaded with sodium, loaded usually with monosodium glutamate, full of great flavor, naturally. Not naturally, but just artificially, actually. So go find a good ranch dressing, you know, one of the better ones on the market. You know, you'll find it. And then what I do is I'll take that ranch dressing and then I will literally cut it like half and half with plain Greek yogurt. Nobody would ever be the wiser. You're putting into it protein, a fat-free, calcium-rich protein yogurt, and cutting the fat and the sodium of the ranch dressing in half.
Now, that sounds absolutely wonderful and something that is sort of masked, but it doesn't matter because of the flavor of the yogurt. But when you're adding other things like your orange puree or even your purple puree, is the trick doing it in steps so your kids won't say, this tastes funny and I'm not eating it?
You know, I don't mean to, I totally appreciate what you're saying, but I've tested everything in my book, so I'm ultra conservative, so that if you do, you know, use the Sneaky Chef recipes, almost fail safe in every case that I've tested them. Most people go the opposite, and they'll say, you know what, I was able to use twice as much puree as you recommended. I'm very, very conservative for that very reason, Katie. I don't want people's kids to say, hey, I tasted something weird in here. But, you know, usually the kids are in on our little secret, and they love it. So Sneaky Chef is long ago, 5 books ago, kids were discovering how fun it is, and they're, you don't have to really hide it on them. They love the fact that we're taking this weird thing like cauliflower and making it into, you know, their favorite spaghetti and meatballs. But nonetheless, I'm very, very conservative, so they don't get outed and they don't get found out if they are really hiding it. You can't taste it. In the ranch dressing example, ranch dressing has such a strong flavor, it masks the taste of that yogurt you mixed in. You could even get into their cauliflower puree, zucchini, and all these things are fairly simple to do. I also have a lot of instant substitutes for my homemade purees in the new book.
So I'd like to look at some of the other recipes in the creamy chicken risotto cakes. They were a mix of reusing and getting in several different extras.
Yes, I love that recipe. A lot of people haven't talked about that one. It's funny. It's just, you never know what people are going to talk about. The book's only, you know, a couple of weeks old, and people are talking about all kinds of recipes. That one they haven't mentioned yet, so I'm glad you did. There's an innovative new product out there, whole grain white rice, which is pretty cool. So I'm using that by Uncle Ben's, you know, and that's one of the innovations out there that's very clever. They're not bleaching it, you know. I won't go on about it, but suffice it to say it's a white rice that looks like white and tastes like white, but it actually has the benefits of whole grain. And to make a risotto cake, see, it's really super fun. Anything you can sort of make into a pancake style, the kids love more. And I was able to get into that, my cauliflower zucchini puree or the carrot puree. You can even use baby food. And a bunch of flaxseed, actually, and some rotisserie chicken that's already cooked up. You know, I use that a lot in this book. And even wheat germ, another whole grain. And top it all off with a little reduced-fat cheese. And it really becomes quite a fun risotto cake. Not very fancy. My food's not fancy. It just tastes really good, and it's a heck of a lot healthier than the traditional counterpart of that food. Normal risotto will knock your socks off with fat, and this one's really slimmed down a bunch.
It is all about the taste, though.
Well, sure. I mean, absolutely. Taste is king, and it will always be the king. I'm trying to give people the best of both worlds, so you can really have your brownies and eat them too. Maybe they're laced with, you know, the blueberries and spinach, believe it or not. Try that anytime. Go to a birthday party, bring those brownies of mine, and, you know, people like to guess, you know, say, oh, there's a hidden vegetable, a hidden fruit in there, and people will never guess which ones are in there, but it's a lot of fun trying.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then before we go, the Elvis breakfast ice cream. I mean, that's just a rockin' way to get started in the morning.
Any breakfast ice cream is super fun, I'll tell you, because the name alone is going to get kids out of bed in the morning. I'm eating it for dessert because I'm trying to cut back on the heavy stuff, on the real ice cream. But Elvis, he was known for peanut butter, bananas, and bacon. So this ice cream is a base of frozen bananas, which I keep peeled and frozen, chopped up in my freezer all the time. And then the peanut butter adds a really good richness that keeps you kind of full all morning long so your kids don't get hungry during math class. And the bacon's optional, of course. But it's really fun. It's like my breakfast ice cream is almost like a soft serve consistency. And if you throw it into an ice cream cone, which has 10 calories and no sugar, it's a heck of a lot better than even your best, you know, lowest sugar breakfast cereal on the market. And kids just think you're both crazy and super awesome. I mean, they love that mom's giving them an ice cream cone in the morning. You could probably put steamed broccoli in there outright and they'd eat it.
Again, the name of Missy Chase Lapine's book is The Speedy Sneaky Chef. She spoke with the Health Show's Katie Britton. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.